Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, the leading authority on cyber, information security, and risk management. I'm Tavia Gilbert, and I'm glad to welcome you back to another cutting-edge conversation tailored to CISOs, CTOs, CROs, and other global security pros. In every episode of ISF's media, Managing Director Steve Durbin speaks with rule breakers, collaborators, culture builders, and business creatives who manage their enterprises with vision, transparency, authenticity, and integrity. And he brings that conversation to you, your teams, and your partners. Today, Steve speaks with a guest whose focus includes human culture, behavior, and storytelling. Singer-songwriter and activist Sir Bob Geldof, lead singer of the Boomtown Rats and founding member of Band Aid, famous for raising money for Ethiopian famine relief. In today's episode, Steve and Sir Bob discuss the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on creativity, the political turmoil facilitated by rapidly advancing digital technology, Sir Bob's hope for fresh ideas, the courage to embrace change, and more.
So, Bob, I'd describe you as a creative, a performer. How's life been for you during lockdown?
Well, let me frame this in context. The Boomtown Rats brought out a new album, a new book, a new film, announced a long, big tour of Britain, two videos, two singles, one day before lockdown. So not so good, is the quick answer. I mean, just wiped out, you know, 2 years of work. I mean, it's hard work, a book, a film, you know, all the graphics for a tour, writing, recording an album. How did it feel? For a while, I kept going because I was doing interviews with American Australia. So, you know, there'd be an interview schedule, but it was frankly pointless. You would think that because now of digital technology, it wouldn't make any difference. You'd still sell them. No, not if you're an old geezer like us. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to have physical product. You need to be able to physically go out and promote it. You need to do TV. You need to do the radio stations. Not possible. Right. They were all in lockdown. So then I just, like everyone else, shut down. And lucky on me, I've got a big garden. And I have the most washed car in the UK, the most mowed lawn in the UK, you know.
But you've worked with the Rats for years. One of the things that struck me when I was doing some of the research for this was that you gel together as a team when you get together, and you do that fairly quickly. Yeah. How did they cope with it? Because suddenly, you know, you've built up to this, we're just about to go out and do something really great, really fun, and suddenly, bang, it all goes.
I don't know how they dealt with it because, you know, we're all over the country. Gary's in the Midlands, Simon's in the West Country, Pete's in West London, I'm in Kent. But what we did do was, again, fantastic new technology. We were able to make two separate videos just with our phones and cameras, sending them up to a mate who assembled them all. And, like, you know, I wrote out what it should be. And then he assembled it all. And, you know, what would have taken us 2 days and thousands of pounds in the past and endless reproductions, you know, gets done like that. So we were able to do that. And to your point, I could actually write songs if I felt like it, send them up to the guys and say, you know, I'd go, can the guitar riff is ding, 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 or play it myself and ask the guitar player to add and embellish it. And you can mix and do all that stuff. But I just wasn't in the mood. Like, I think like most people, I zoned out and thoroughly enjoyed the most gorgeous spring, you know. I mean, I hadn't lived in spring since, I suppose, I was a child. I don't remember spring, you know. And it was so beautiful, so perfect. And as I say, I've got a big garden. Plus, I had the kids and the husbands down and staying. And that was nice, you know. We didn't get on each other's nerves. We did stuff like we had an outdoor cinema because the summer became better than the spring in terms of weather. It was really great. And it is a sort of, I thought, this sort of lacuna moment in a life where you look back and say, that was really, for me, quite magical. Mm-hmm. Having said that, perfectly aware I don't live on the 18th floor with one bedroom and three children. You know, I mean, I just got lucky.
Right. And you mentioned this use of digital technology. I mean, everybody's using that, right? We've all been forced into it from the perspective of lockdown. That's how, certainly, if I look at the ISF, we've managed to keep people together, interestingly. I'm interested in your thoughts on technology. So, you know, I've heard you talk about the fact that technology is all pervasive. Tell me a little bit about your views more deeply, though. Is it a force for good? Do you see it as something that is for evil? Is it somewhere in between? Where do you really sit in terms of the way that we as society have adopted technology, almost like a third arm?
This is the most significant instrument of change in human history, no question. So, as I say, change can be good or bad. And it's tilting towards the bad in the balance. There is no great virtue in being able to talk to people instantly. There's no great virtue in talking to your actual friends and then having thousands of pretend friends. There's no great virtue in just blurting out unthinking comments and that becoming news. There's no great virtue in any of these things. There is a great possibility, which those who wrote the codes regret now, that that hasn't been realised. And it has become essentially slave to a newer economy, but no one quite understands how that economy functions. Mm. And it functions at a far faster rate than we actually can process that, than the markets can process it. And that leads to collapse. And the human consequence of that is instability, war, chaos, all those things. We've seen that permanently, though, over the last X years, like at least a decade of this. And we've seen the change that it has produced, whether that's in the migrants currently drowning in the Mediterranean Ocean, whether it's the wars which produce the millions flooding to us for a safer life, whether it's the economic collapse which produces the migrants looking to us for jobs and the collapse of houses, yada, yada, yada. It's done all that. And the confusion this has created, the question you've asked, the confusion has given rise to a deeply troubling older type of politics. I cannot honestly, in all fairness, with I'm not a nutter about this, I can't see a difference between the mafia thuggery of Putin, the absolute autocracy of Xi Jinping, the Islamic nationalism of Erdogan, we've seen it before, the inept emptiness of a Johnson, the utter idiocy of a vulgar fool like Trump. This is not good. We can tolerate it up to a point, certainly in Britain. Mm-hmm. There you go. There he is, getting on my case. but it's a moot point as to how far America, straining as it is, with all its contradictions, which this new technology has risen to the fore, and it's exacerbated it. Myth will always triumph over reason. Belief will always triumph over reason because it cannot be disproved. And the web is an instrument of rumor. So you get QAnon, you get all these mad stuff. And we are led towards that. You know, we have this, the algorithms take us towards this. As I said, it mines our heads. We are the product. And that's very dangerous. And it nudges us towards an extreme. It does so, you know, without thinking, without sentient. It eliminates choice.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? You mentioned there the algorithm, the role of the algorithm, the elimination of choice. I think if I look at the technological environment, one of the things that concerns me most is that you can determine yourself what it is that you want to see. So if I don't agree with your views, I never need to see them again in my technology world.
Exactly.
And how do you then carve up the difference between the world that you're self-creating, which is self-perpetuating your own views, versus what we would like to think is reality? Because actually there is this shift that's beginning to take place, isn't there? And the question that I always ask myself around that is, how do we step back, if you like, from that brink that we're now teetering on?
Well, it's confirmation bias, which we always knew about, which is why the BBC mandate is a must-have balance, because we've always understood the great danger. You know, America deals with it by having Fox and CNN. But the more extreme Fox becomes, the more it behaves like an app, the more it attracts viewers. So confirmation bias isolates you. You become a ghetto of the self, a silo of your own known self-interest. And it pushes you towards more of an extreme. So if you like this, you like that. And if, for example, you just happen to go on to look at the riots in Kenosha, it'll see that and then give you more riots. And then what's it, you become, you know, you drags you in more. You see it with the pornography. You can see the figures of where pornography takes people, you know, into more and more extremes, curiosity or whatever. And that is a profound danger, but that is entirely what the economy is built upon. So the notion of serendipity, of being in a pub and meeting someone with an opposing view that seems novel to you and you wish to engage in, that's eliminated because you're certain of your own sense and belief. The serendipity of going into a record shop and hearing something there that is not, if you like this, you like that. It's true that if I like the Rolling Stones, it's likely I like something akin. But the serendipity of going in and suddenly hearing Billie Holiday or something is lost. The serendipity of going in to buy a book in a bookshop and noodling along and seeing somebody else reading something, that's gone. And so it narrows our world extremely. And narrow worlds is not where we should be at the moment. We need to be expansive in the nth.
So is there a way that we can almost, I don't think we can wind the clock back, but is there a way that we can rebalance?
I don't think so. Nationalism is the political expression of narrowness. You know, nationalism is a ghetto of itself, of a national self. And given that globalization, people say, was a bust, it marginalized, not at all. Globalization is a continuing, functioning, organic expression of the economy. And because of the connectivity of the world, not least through the internet, it will continue. But we rebel against it and think it's doing us great harm. I mean, you know, the epiphenomenon. You know, globalization is the singular economic event of our time, and the epiphenomenon of that are the populist parties, stagnant wages, unemployed millions, the technocratic and surveillance state. And that gives rise to all the political upset we have at the moment, the populist parties that rail against this planetary swirl of people, capital and ideas, because they're afraid. And it needs to be exactly the opposite.
Right.
It needs to be a period of deep understanding and tolerance and expansiveness as ever, or else. I can't stress it more, like I just feel this. And I'm really not a pessimist. As I said, you know, earlier, you don't do Live Aid and Live 8 and believe there's a possibility of getting out of this. And we got out of it from a little Christmas record. We were able to write the agenda for the world's most powerful leaders and get them to agree. Took 20 years, but what's that? So that system worked for that time. It cannot work for now. We've seen that. It will not work for now. And the philosophies that guide it are inappropriate. There just isn't a philosophy or an understanding, a political understanding of what this world is. And so you get the strong man, who is in fact utterly weak. Authority tends towards authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is autocracy. It will always fail because it can't allow individuals to be free, which is what they ultimately want, ultimately.
Again, it's a very interesting point you make there. I was talking earlier on today to Dame Inga Beale, who was making the point that from her perspective, she sees the role of the business leader as having to emerge and morph more into
I thought that overall I thought
leadership.
That for a while. I thought that's the only place to go. It's the only institution, if you like. You know, as Christian churches become more and more nuttier in the United States, where the established religions just really aren't believed anymore. It's the great secular religion of science, which, you know, the benefit of science is you can believe it or not. But science will always be true, you know. So I thought business must, that's it. That must be where it's going. But seriously, Zuckerberg, Jack Ma, you know, Bill Gates understood that. Bill got out. I mean, I know Bill worked with him in Africa and decided to dedicate his great wealth to not just mitigating currency. I mean, you were looking at one man who may really personally eradicate polio, one of the great historic evils of the world, because he wrote code some afternoons with his mate in Stanford or whatever. And, you know, I think he sees clearly the danger of this, but he's in no position to lecture Larry, Sergey, Mark, Jack, or the guys. I'm not even sure he's interested. But he does, you know, occasionally issue a warning. So that's from inside the tent. Mm-hmm. I personally think that, you know, some people are outside the tent pissing in. Some are inside and piss out. Boris Johnson, basically, and the rest of us. And some get inside the tent and decide to just piss in there. Well, that's me. So, you know, and but that's trite. And it just cannot be a couple of activists. It just can't be. The books of this century, and we still need books, have been written. We just don't know what they are, in the same way that Darwin, Freud and Marx were probably the touchstones of the 20th century. You can need almost anything back to those three powerful ideas that moved the 20th century. Darwin, Freud and Marx of our time probably have written. We just won't know that until maybe 2050. It might be too late. But even then, they didn't really posit. They just said stuff that seemed applicable to our society at the time. Maybe it's Piketty. Maybe it's Zuboff. Maybe it's one of these people. Maybe it's others. I kind of think that Marshall McLuhan might have been onto something. Someone like James Lovelock, who was 100 a couple of months ago. His book, Nova Scene, is probably important. But we're groping.
Right. There is a vacuum, isn't there? That's the point.
And what happens in a vacuum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if there's anybody listening to this who's, I don't know, leading an organisation, who aspires to be a leader, somebody who is perhaps frustrated by some of the things that we've just been talking about, what sort of advice would you give them?
You know, if there is to be a leadership thing, people always go on about leadership and I've crapped on about it, but I don't really believe it. I have talked about the sort of thing that I'm familiar with. Given my background, and I had no choice, I didn't do any work in school and I felt I wasn't in any way interested in, we were a big sporting school, wasn't interested in, you know, anything to do with the school. And there was no one at home to make me do any work, so I read. Mm-hmm. So the first thing, people say, what advice do you give my children? Read. Really read. Not on Kindle, where we know that's dead because people prefer the physicality. Why do they prefer that? That's the first thing. There's something exciting. I've got a library and I've forgotten a lot of the books in it, but they can't be thrown out. Why? Because when I see it, some submerged part of my head remembers it and is excited by what I took from it. So I've got not a library of books, but shelves full of feelings. And I sit in there and I enjoy it. I enjoy sitting in there just drinking a coffee and noodling in my head. So the first is to read and not be captured by this stuff. That's right. The first. And because I was deeply uncomfortable with the world that I appeared to inhabit, I needed to invent an own universe within which I could function. Mm-hmm. That was key. And so let's look at the other people who I wasn't on the spectrum, I don't think. I don't think I am on the spectrum. But Richard Branson probably is. He's socially awkward. Bill Gates is socially awkward. Steve Jobs was really, you know, I guess on the spectrum, you know. I mean, I met him a couple of times, not at the most pleasant of guys. Geeks, you know, they're socially awkward. Winston Churchill, deeply unhappy, useless at school. These people invented somewhere and something around them that they could make the world understandable and therefore they could use it. Mm-hmm. And they gathered about them people that could enable this world. So this is the entrepreneurial type. Yeah. And people confuse that with the type of leadership. Now, all the people I've mentioned are, I suppose, in your view, a type of leader. But Churchill was absolutely hopeless until come at the moment, come at the man, mm-hmm. you know, and then he was hopeless afterwards. He was just good at weaponizing the English language, as they say. But a lot of his decisions, even during the war, the Alan Brooke and all the other chiefs were going for, you know, whatever. But he was a politician. Richard went out and created his own idea of the way things should be that suited him. And so did a lot of the tech entrepreneurs. So is that a type of leadership? You know, earlier I quoted George Bernard Shaw, who's a fellow Irish skeptic, who said the world is made by unreasonable people. Mm-hmm. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable persists in the world adapting themselves to him. Therefore, all change comes through the power of unreasonable people. I urge people to be as unreasonable as possible, to question, to query. The band always say, you know what, Gulliv? You fucking die. We're just going to put the word why on your tombstone, you know, because it's always a why. Things are going to change mm-hmm. constantly. The world is not immutable. You can maybe a tiny bit help to change it and steer it in the direction you'd prefer it to go. Now, that necessitates a commonality of purpose. That necessitates a societal impulse. And as I said, the paradox of individualism, which is what our economy and our politics is built upon, the paradox at the heart of individualism is that it only works when we act together in concert for the common good. You will not survive in a desert on your own. You will not survive in the bush on your own. You won't survive in a city on your own. Look at the mental health problems thrown up by the pandemic, the loneliness. You don't survive. It's only through cooperation. It's only through consensus. It's only through compromise. And the leader that can amalgamate that in the self and with a sense of purpose, that's why we talk about a societal leader, one who's far more horizontal in the administrative networks that they require to build. And I suspect that the web requires that. It's supposed to be the flat world now, mm-hmm. that this thing makes everyone equal. Of course it doesn't. If you're more tech savvy, if you've got different apps, if you can, you know, it should be easier to do. But as we've discussed, the web appears to act in a contradictory manner. And Tim Berners-Lee, who I got to know, the Gutenberg of our times, you know, Gutenberg times 6 billion is exactly what the web is. He's in despair. He's in despair at what this magnificent construct that he just imagined and understood completely what it was when he called it the World Wide Web, even though 10 people were using it. An immense vision. But visionaries are often not leaders. They shouldn't be near the leader stick, mm-hmm. you know. You see what happens when they get their hands
on it. And for me, leadership or taking a stand, driving something forward, is exceptionally difficult to do on your own. And I think the real art in there is identifying that you cannot do it on your own. You have to have a team of people around you
completely.
That you can work with. And similarly, when you're composing, for instance, you probably don't do it on your own, right?
I do, but then can't you bounce enable off. The song,
right?
The stuff in my head, because I can't play drums, I can't play piano, I'm a shit guitar player, I'm not interested in producing it. But I'd be going, no, it's not that. I say, well, what is it? I'm not in your head. You know, I say, no, not niddle, niddle, it's needle, 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 you know, stuff like that. Or no, bring that up, that's how it goes. But go back even further. Starting a band is the classic entrepreneurial activity. You know, I wasn't writing songs. Well, I when I was a kid, wrote loads of stuff, but I never expected to be in a band. I had no ambition to be in a band. I never, you know, it just came. Mm-hmm. I went to the pub one night and two of the guys from down the road were saying, okay, we'll do it. The Boomtown Rats would never, ever have worked had we not written the songs, one. The necessity of writing the songs meant that I had to have a really great drummer.
Right.
No band that you listen to has got a crap drummer. None. Okay. Or a machine that does it. Okay. I really hear piano. Got to have a great piano. I'm crap at guitar. Let's do that. We want to be like the Rolling Stones. Let's get a great, great rhythm. And so the band coheres around one character largely, that they all agree, without saying it, without stating it, but instinctively and intuitively what Colin Wilson called in his 1960s book, One in Five. Mm-hmm. Out of every group of five, one will emerge organically, and the other four will allow that person to take the group forward until such time as they are redundant and don't know where to go, and then they'll get rid of them and somebody else will step forward. That's how we all work. That's how a band works. Bands break up. And the only reason they don't break up is because they have to sit down and really trash out a lot of their personal problems, their rivalries and things. So the great bands who've survived, the Rolling Stones, famously we know about Mick and Keith not standing each other, but having to be together, because that's the only way they can write. We know about the Sweet and Sour of John and Paul, you know, all of this. So that's it. You have to sit down and negotiate a future. And so any entrepreneurial activity is like that. You know, Bill Gates without Paul Allen, Steve Jobs without Wozniak, you know, and gathering others around them. It always starts at that. It's always a group, and the group will find someone. But what we've got now are blowhards and buffoons, people who scramble up the greasy pole through armies, through thugs, through thuggery or whatever, or through bombast or through new media or through lies or through wealth. You know, not good.
And your thoughts for the future? You said earlier you don't want to be viewed as being a pessimist. You know, you do have some optimistic perspectives. What is your hope for the future?
It's not a hope for the future. I'd love to see how it turns out. But then if I was around to see how it turns out, I'd want to see how it turns out next. What next? So we're human, profoundly flawed. There are so many of us. We require massive stability. Our cultures bash up against each other. The historical cultural past of borders and religions, they bash up against each other. We will have to go through a great period of turbulence where this ameliorates itself. We are currently using up the planet very, very quickly. We are in an extinction moment of at least 75% of the known species on the planet. Well, that's the end of us, even if we're not included in that. We could be in a transitional moment. You know, this is where you get all weird about where humans go. Mm-hmm. Professor Lovelock, who was the NASA scientist dealing with chemicals on the moon before the lads went there, then dealing with the Martian chemicals in their atmosphere, then turned his attention to Earth and found the ozone layer predicted was there, got CFCs cancelled. He's the one, the proponent of the Gaia theory of how the world functions, a singular self-functioning organism. He thinks that we'd either go the way of the world, evolution will just shiver like we're a pandemic and get rid of us. Or he thinks we're very far on the road to a new form of life, which is just as organic, but essentially informational and electronic. And we're just the progenitors of that. They're next. They'll be benign towards us, that sort of thing, which sounds bonkers, except this guy is pretty cool. He's got a lot right so far. So maybe that's going to happen. Thanks. Don't want to be around for that. Or maybe it's the same old, same old. Maybe it is moments of great technological change that tear down the elites and their sense that their political systems and therefore their economic systems. And that leads to war. It leads to loss of income, loss of homes, great societal confusion. And that leads to bloodletting. Why we do that, I've no idea. But it's almost like, oh, to hell with it, let's get on with it. And it bursts out and millions are dead. And then we try, what have we done? And we try to reassemble ourselves coherently. And then we go again. It's not mad to say that. It happened with the move from feudal to industrial period with the steam engine, the European Napoleonic Wars. The Napoleonic Wars happened because society blew up because of this new economy and a dictator arrived, a genius, Napoleon, who tried to impose order across everything and a new politics, which was required. The old order tried to reassert itself. It came to a head with the new technologies of electricity and the internal combustion, a great cultural suicide, millions upon millions of boys and girls dead. And that followed. And then a great economic collapse, a great pandemic led to the rise of a brute again. Also understandable when you see it. One man positing a direction. Say it's simple, it's this way. Mm-hmm. Mad ideas of idealism. The one good thing about Trump is he doesn't have a fucking ideal in his head, except me, you know. So I can't see us not repeating this. Russia goes back to a Tsar. Mm-hmm. China goes back to an emperor. Turkey goes back to the Ottoman emperors.
And I suspect that the only thing that is for certain is that it will change and we'll just have to wait to
see.
So
long as it's literally not a revolution.
Right.
Just revolving around the same old. Are we doomed to this? Are we so narrow? Are we so limited to think afresh and anew? To not be afraid of change, rather to encourage it. Not to let it run rampant, but to identify the thing that I say, a change can be good or bad, but it's only good when it meets the needs of and is balanced by the requirements of society. So the need of society for something like technology, information technology, is clearly there. But is it balanced by the requirement of what society actually requires? No, it's not. And that's where the imbalance is. And so long as the world is imbalanced and asymmetric, instability is inherent to asymmetry, it will fall over.
And on that rather sort of, perhaps not quite as uplifting as I'd hoped for, but at least on that very sort of...
Hey, guys like us, I'm out of here. I'm 69, I'm done.
Sir Bob Geldof, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Fascinating conversation from an accomplished musician, activist, and clearly a student of history, with an impressive grasp on our current disruption in the context of our past. Sir Bob leaves us on that cautionary note. We have an opportunity to rise to the moment, to transform our systems and societies in ways that better serve humanity, or we can reject creative new thinking, terrified of change, and repeat our catastrophic history. If you enjoyed the conversation, check the media page at securityforum.org, where tomorrow the video of this interview with Steve Durbin and Sir Bob Geldof goes live. In our next episode, we'll be speaking with another guest whose work incorporates music, Reggie Butler. Founder and CEO of Performance Paradigm returns to speak with Steve 2 years after their last conversation. And in addition to the video of Sir Bob, you can also find the video of Reggie and Steve at securityforum.org/podcasts-videos. Here's Reggie in a clip from that 2018 episode, in which he talks about finding a cadence or a harmonic flow when working with a virtual team.
If I'm working with you virtually, you're in another country in another time zone, what are the expectations for how involved we will be and what will we be doing at those times, whether they're on times, off times, peak times, whatever it is, we have to create that cadence in a virtual format. You would never doubt, if it were someone in your family, how to adjust and adapt toward a different cadence.
Right.
If someone moved out of your home and they moved to another side of the globe, you would find a way to virtually stay connected. If you cared. If you're working with a virtual team, you have to care about them first. You have to know what they're working on before you can create the cadence.
We look forward to bringing you a fresh new conversation with Reggie next week. In the meantime, we invite you to tune into our catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. If you feel as though today's conversation was of value, you can subscribe to the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be very grateful if you'd recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you these timely discussions. You can always join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page or get in touch directly through our website, where you can also download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like these. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Assistant producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.